Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest Open Door, Open City podcast. I'm Karina Robinson, co-director of the Inclusion Initiative at the London School of Economics. We use behavioral science and data to help create more diverse and inclusive cultures in business. Our aim is not to criticize, but to help business on its route to improve profitability through a more diverse workforce and a more inclusive culture. Our guest today is Alderman Vincent Keaveney, the 693rd Lord Mayor of the City of London. Welcome, Lord Mayor.
Hello, Karina. It's great to be on the podcast.
Now, some of our listeners will think, although you're not wearing all your diamonds and lace and velvet today, that your role is all about just dressing up. And really, what else do you do? So you must tell them what you do.
Well, there is, I suppose, a little bit of that. You know, I can't deny that there are moments when I do get into some extraordinary outfits and gowns. And there's an element around the role, emphasising that historical role that the Lord Mayor plays. And certainly over the past few months, that has been a remarkable feature of the year. In fact, the historical events that I participated in as Lord Mayor. But the reality is that's probably less than 5% of the mayoral role. The other 95% is being an ambassador, a representative for the UK's financial and professional services sector, and indeed increasingly as well our tech sector. And that involves traveling, getting messages out about the fantastic financial services and professional services here in the United Kingdom. It's all the United Kingdom as well. I'm not just speaking on behalf of the Square Mile, the City of London, but the wider UK ecosystem too. So it's a great role, that ambassador. It's amazing. You're combining this ancient history on the one hand with talking about the most cutting edge issues in finance, in tech, in professional services, really at the forefront of innovation and the most current developments in the sector.
It's quite true what you were saying about, you know, the city. The city is basically a sort of a short name for not just the square mile, but financial professional services throughout the UK. And that provides 10%, more or less, give and take every year, of tax revenues, which is a lot of hospitals, a lot of schools. Do you think the city gets this across properly? Do we communicate it properly?
No, we don't. That has been a long-standing concern of me, of my predecessors as Lord Mayors as well, and how we do think we've been trying to get the message out much more clearly. And we've taken some steps, produced some material, for instance, produced some reports that we can working with government to get the message out. As you say, it's contributes a significant percentage of tax revenue. 2.2, a little bit over 2.2 million people work in financial and professional services across the country. There are over 20 cities with more than 10,000 people working in them. In many of those cities, it's the number one employer, financial and professional services. And when you see the way our tech sector is growing as well, this is so important. But yes, we've got to do a better job at communicating the importance of that across the country and indeed across the world.
Yeah. I mean, one of the interesting things is, Brexit obviously was a blow to the city, and it was a blow in terms of the talent we were getting in. But, the government, how should I put this? The government at the moment is not looking great. But overall, the one thing that has been, I think, a great success story, and again, isn't talked about, is all the visas there are for people with high potential, for people who've got PhDs.
I very much agree. I think it has been a very positive development and directly as a response to Brexit, as you say. It's one of the things that the City of London Corporation, previous Lord Mayors, have been advocating for, a more targeted, a supportive visa regime, and not only just the categories of visas, but making sure the processes are rapid, efficient, that people don't have to spend a lot of time and a lot of money to get a visa. I think those are all very important features as well. It's great. Traveling the world, as I have been doing as Lord Mayor this year, that is something that gets remarked upon in many, many of the countries I visit. And the fact as well that we've got record numbers of foreign students we have a record number this year of Indian students, for instance, in our universities. And I think similarly from the Gulf, in the Gulf last week, similar story there. And many of these are students which 5 or 10 years ago, they would have gone to the United States, but they're coming here. There are many of them coming back here to the United Kingdom. And those links between the UK and India, the UK and the Gulf, built on these university connections. And they're going to be links that benefit the UK and our financial professional services for 20, 30, 40 years. They're so important, those links.
You're absolutely right. Whether you stay here after doing your course or whether you go back, it doesn't really matter. It's about the soft power. And it's about, that soft power, which the LSE has been doing that for years and years. They always said that if you ever traveled in what was then called the developing world in the 50s and 60s, every single prime minister and finance minister and central bank governor came from the LSE. Can I just pitch that out there? Now, you talked about travel and you have only 1 year in office. Can you give me a flavor of how many places you visited and also a couple of trips where you felt that your role as ambassador, they were very effective at communicating your message?
Well, over the course of the year, I suppose in a normal year, the Lord Mayor spends somewhere between 80 and 100 days traveling. I probably somewhere between about 80 and 90 days. I have to sit down and actually, I haven't sat down and worked out, done the calculation in terms of number of days and number of countries. In terms of countries, I think it's between 20 and 25 that I visited, which would be fairly typical. Might squeeze one more or two more in. Sadly, I wasn't able. Australia was on the travel plans, and I had to withdraw from that trip as it coincided with the death of Her Late Majesty. So, I that was the one trip I wasn't able to do this year. And that's South America, Asia Pacific, Japan, Indonesia, India, the Gulf. Europe as well. I visited a number of European countries. And then, of course, North America, the US and Canada, two trips to the US. So a very, very wide-ranging travel program. In terms of places, particular trips, one that resonate, of course, I'm Irish. I grew up in Dublin. And I had a great trip, a very interesting, very satisfying trip to Ireland back in March. It was a great trip. We had lots of very good meetings around the financial professional services agenda, around tech and fintech and the complementary financial centres, Dublin and London. But of course, there was then an element of homecoming about it as well. So visiting my universities in Dublin, seeing friends, that was a very special trip to make as the first Irish national to serve as Lord Mayor. Very, very, very special. But every trip was special in its own way. I love India, the energy in Bangalore, the fintech sector in Bangalore, that's tremendous. And some really interesting meetings in Tokyo, in Japan, where again, another aspect, being able to be able to put positive, reassuring messages out into about the UK, about the city, about the future of our financial services. Many of the major Japanese financial institutions, of course, have huge investments here in the UK, and be able to talk to them about those investments, the infrastructure they built here in London, and to be able to give very positive messages about the future of the UK, I think is part of the role that Lord Mayor plays. So, but it's been such a pleasure to. Of course, being one of the great things is actually being able to travel again. That in itself has been just a pleasure. Meeting people. The number of times I've gone into meetings as the first person from the UK in that particular country, as an official visitor from the country, that's I suppose, being one of the features of my travels this year. And it's great to the reception you get. You're the first person they've seen from the UK in 2.5 years.
When they see you, Lord Mayor, do they also see, do you travel with a few chairs, CEOs of British companies as well?
We do. That is a feature of mayoral travel. We've had to, that's probably come back in the second half of my year, much more strongly than the first half. The first half of the year, of course, we were still juggling with COVID restrictions and the risks associated with COVID. So actually traveling with the delegation in the first half of the year was a bit challenging. If one of us had tested positive, we'd all have probably ended up sitting in an hotel in San Francisco for 10 days isolating. There were risks we just had to manage. So delegations were a little bit tricky, but more recently, yes, we've had senior representatives of UK businesses, UK trade associations. I'm doing a particular piece of work this year that's leading a campaign which will be a multi-year campaign. We're working with the Investment Association, the buy-side trade body for the investment management industry here in the UK. They've been supporting my travels, joining me in meetings in Asia Pacific, The London Stock Exchange very often is they will, representatives of the London Stock Exchange will travel with me as, again, a key element of the financial services ecosystem here in London.
What, you know, you said part of it is about reassuring that, you know, the city is still here, it's still as welcoming as it's always been. You know, we are still one of the top three financial centres in the world. And all sorts of things have been thrown at us, including the financial crisis and Brexit, and we still are. The other day, I came up with this analogy. If we were a human being, the city would be an insecure overachiever, never stops trying hard. What, when you went to, I don't know, Qatar, Tokyo, what came up in the conversation where you had to reassure? Was it Brexit? Was it something else? Was it the government? What, where did you have to communicate the most?
Well, the conversations do vary depending, of course, and if you're in the Gulf, for instance, there's very significant investments made by the sovereign wealth funds, whether it's from Qatar, or Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, they are very, very significant investors. And so they understand, they are very close to what's going on here in the United Kingdom. And they're always looking for perspectives, personal views, as much as official views, just to get a sense of with the direction of the country. And you can have conversations which just assist their thinking about their, the future of their investments. I have to say, despite the market turbulence of the last couple of months, they remain very positive about the UK and will continue to and are continuing to invest in projects here. So there's the reassurance you can give about the long-term stability. One of the great things, of course, about this office is, and you can say it slightly tongue-in-cheek, but I can say it, that there have been Lord Mayors in the office I'm sitting in here at Mansion House, as Lord Mayors have sat in this office since 1752. The office goes back to 1189. There's not much a Lord Mayor, the office of Lord Mayor, hasn't seen. And London, as you say, is still, I would say, actually the number one global financial centre in terms of our international outreach. So I think you can give very positive messages about that. As I say, sometimes it's about Brexit. That can be, interestingly, at the beginning of the year, when I was traveling in Spain and Portugal, a lot of the conversations were about very small things, about the experience coming through the UK border at airports, and the need to think about how interactions like that need to be better, how we improve, just the small things like that, because they make a difference. The first person somebody sees coming to the UK is going to be the border force officer that stamps their passport in Heathrow or whichever airport it is. And I think that there were the conversations about that, and great to have the ambassador in Spain, the ambassador in Portugal sitting beside me, because they can pick that up and feed that back to the immigration of the Home Office and border force here. And similarly in Japan, it was very much to say about commitments made, and the Japanese banks have made big, big commitments here. They've had to think about how those commitments work in relation to the post-Brexit regulatory environment, and they've made the regulatory adjustments necessary to continue to service their clients in Europe. So a lot of it is about reassuring them about the long-term future and the stability of London as a financial centre. Very positive conversations, despite some of those little challenges you'll get from time to time.
The city, we've just talked about how it's not really a financial place in a certain sense. It's throughout the UK, but it is also a physical place. And I remember when I started out in the city, my first ever job was the Spanish analyst at a bank that was then taken over, 86, and the city at night was dead. You now go to the city at night, amazing nightlife. I mean, how has the vision of the city changed?
I remember sort of the late 80s when I started working in the city as well, the same thing. You know, I think it was most of the pubs shut by 8 o'clock. I mean, it really was. And Saturdays and Sundays, there was nothing happening in the city. It was a ghost town. But it has changed. Living here in Mansion House this year, going out, taking the dog out for a late night walk and on a Saturday night in Bank Junction, just seeing the life around the place, it's totally transformed, which is fantastic. And we're continuing to develop that. We recognise that the city has to be more than just. I mean, one of the great attractions as a place for people to come and work is having all of the rest of that life around the city as well. And it's actually part of the offer for workers, it's part of the offer for residents and for visitors. And so we're in the City of London, post-pandemic, we've taken a look at where we are and where we need to invest. And we're investing over £2 million a year for the next couple of years in a program called Destination City, which is really going to focus on the city's wider offering as a place to enjoy spending time, whether that's as a worker, a resident, or a visitor. One of the first events tomorrow, Saturday, the 15th of October, the kickoff event, the inaugural event for Destination City, the Golden Key event, lots of street theater activities, a treasure hunt happening around the city to start off this program of this multi-year program, Destination City, promoting our attractions.
Now, we're living through a terrible cost of living crisis, and it's going to be lasting for at least a couple of years. What is the city or the City of London Corporation doing about it?
Well, it's the ultimately, we've got to be realistic in terms of what we as a local authority, an institution, the City Corporation, can actually do. These are national issues which ultimately require national government solutions and support. But what we can do is within the financial services industry is highlight these issues, and it's something that with my theme this year, people and purpose, investing in a better tomorrow, with my successor Alderman Nicholas Lyons's theme, financing our future, and we're both very focused on the need for the financial services industry to recognise the challenge that this cost of living crisis is posing for many, many millions of people around the country. Nick mentioned to me the other day a statistic which really sticks in my head, that there's 17 million people in this country with savings of less than £100.
Are people who are working.
Well, 15, that's the amazing, that the even more stark number is that 15 million of them are in work, in employment. So it's not as if it's a case of them going out and finding a job and be able to improve their situation. Most of them are working really hard, and they're maximizing their income already, and they still are in this precarious financial position. So we need the financial service industry needs to think about this, and in the corporation, in the city, we will be talking about this in the coming months, how we can respond to it as an industry. And we will need an industry-wide response, irrespective of whatever other measures the government introduces in the coming months.
Now, the new government came up with an economic plan, which I noticed a lot of commentators, not the FT, but a lot of the other ones, said it was very friendly to the city. So it was getting rid of the restrictions on bankers' bonuses, dropping the top rate of tax from 45% to 40%, keeping corporate tax rates at 19% rather than 25%. Yet, interestingly, the city, nobody I know in the city ever asked for any of this. So what is on the city's actual wish list?
Well, the city, I think what we are, if we're aligned with the government about anything, we're aligned on the growth agenda and ensuring that there is a focus on growth. And that's not just in terms of tax revenues, but it's in terms of promoting growth companies, making sure they can list the companies of the future on the London Stock Exchange, that they have that opportunity, that we get capital going into the growth sectors of the economy, the investments, whether it's into sustainable infrastructure around the country, creating new green jobs. Those are the sorts of areas where we are really focused in the city, those opportunities. And some of that would require some regulatory change. Some of that green investment, for instance, that will come from the legal in generals of the prudentials coming from companies which have large amounts of capital to invest in long-term assets, that will require some regulatory change, and some of that regulatory change is coming through. So we're working with the government. We hope that we'll continue to see some of these necessary regulatory changes that promote the growth economy, the growth agenda. We're very supportive of the financial. There's a piece of legislation going through Parliament at the moment. It's coming up next week for its committee readings in the House of Commons, the Financial Services and Markets Bill. This is a really significant piece of financial services legislation. And we are very supportive of the government in getting that legislation through Parliament. But those are areas where we can work. We're very supportive of what the government is doing. We're trying to make sure that we keep our focus on those areas that will benefit the city, but will benefit the world as well. Benefit the UK. Benefit the world. Yeah, it will be fantastic if our pension companies could invest in our long-term infrastructure assets in the United Kingdom. At the moment, it's the Australian pension funds, it's the Canadian pension funds that are making those investments in the UK. It's not the UK pension funds because our regulatory environment doesn't allow them to do that. That needs to change. We need to have our UK pension fund money going into UK sustainable infrastructure investments alongside those Canadian money and that Australian money as well.
Now, looking at the theme for your year, it's people with purpose. Am I right? Can you give us a bit more detail?
People and purpose, yeah. Investing in a better tomorrow. And the couple of elements to that, the people element, that's a strong focus there on skills and social mobility. And the social mobility piece is actually it's work that I've been engaged in for several years now. It's had a particular focus over the last 2 years because of a task force which the government asked the City of London Corporation to set up. November 2 years ago, coming up almost 2 years ago, we were asked to set up a task force to look at a particular issue, which is how we get the wider, that we're doing a lot of good things in the financial services industry, getting a much wider, more diverse group of people coming into the industry, coming in from non-professional, non-traditional backgrounds. If you want to use the technical term, which I don't like particularly, it's lower socioeconomic backgrounds, coming into the industry. But we are seeing evidence that they're not progressing up to senior levels at the same speed as those who come in from some more traditional backgrounds, higher socioeconomic backgrounds. And this isn't linked to performance. This is a really odd, extraordinary thing here. This is all about.
So what is it linked to, Vincent?
We think it's probably a bit about fit and polish and social networks and all of these other things that. And we need to find, we need to break down these hidden barriers to progression. So we've been looking at the problem. The final report of the task force is coming out in November. We've also set up an organization called Progress Together, a financial services membership body, which I'll be chairing. I'll continue to chair that for a couple of years after the mayoralty. We have ambitions over the decade to come. To really make a difference in this area in the financial services industry by providing companies, by providing individuals with some of the tools that they'll need to change the parameters around this issue. So that's the sort of the people focus purpose.
I want to go into this more because I think it's very interesting. I mean, one of the things you're getting together in this is data. And without the data to measure things, you can't sort of get going. So you've got the data. And what are some of the measures you're suggesting or some of the tools that I know you haven't come up with your report yet, but could you anticipate a bit?
Well, I mean, your data, one of the key recommendations is going to be around collection of data. And some data is being collected in the sector already. The Solicitors Regulation Authority, for instance, is requiring solicitors to collect this data. I suspect we'll see other regulators moving in that direction in due course. But collecting data and actually giving companies the tools. I mean, a lot of companies they collect data for some on gender, on sexual orientation, perhaps these days on ethnicity, but social mobility is not something that they've yet managed to find a way to address. And they without knowing where you are, you've got to establish where you are, and data is essential in creating that starting line. Before you can start sort of sorting out a target, you need to know where you are in terms of the journey you're on. So data is so important, and we will be one of the things we'll be offering our members in Progress Together is a data partner service that we will be able to work with firms that haven't yet started to collect data in relation to social mobility. Working with a very experienced organization that is doing this with a number of firms that will actually help firms through some of the issues that almost always come up in this area. When you start collecting data, it's something that people can be particularly sensitive about. You do need to approach this with a great deal of sensitivity. One of the other things we find is that getting senior management, if you have senior management in the firm who have a story themselves to tell about their own journey and life, That is so powerful. But it's very often, it's a hidden thing. Many senior managers, they get to a particular point, and it's not that they've forgotten the journey they're on, or they devalued it, or it's just, it's perhaps it's not any longer part of their story. That, you know, they are now the chief executive. And so you've got to sometimes coax the tail out of them of where they came from and the journey they were on to get where they've got to, and hearing their employees, their co-workers in their organizations, hearing those stories can be really powerful, and then you start creating the right sort of environment to approach people about giving some of this rather personal information about their family backgrounds, what their parents did when they were 16, whether they were preschool children, whatever it happens to be. I mean, there's various ways of measuring this, but it requires a lot of thought and a lot of care to collect that data in a way where you get a good sample of the workforce.
Okay. Sorry, because I interrupted you. What was the second part of your...
Second part is purpose, people and purpose. So the purpose element there, very much focused on the ESG agenda. On the E, I always knew there was going to be a big chunk of E-related work. I took office on the last day of COP26. So my mayoralty was sort of foreshadowed by COP26. And one of the things we've done this year is some follow-up work to COP26, some preparatory work for COP27 in Sharm el Sheikh next month. We hosted here in Mansion House, we hosted in May the Net Zero Delivery Summit. So checking in on those commitments made by the financial services industry back in November in Glasgow. And we looked ahead as well to how those commitments are being translated into action. It's all net zero delivery. The key word there is in the third word, the delivery on this, and trying to encourage delivery. It was a great event. We had Mark Carney came over from Canada. John Kerry was in town, so he spoke at that as well. So we had really good international attendance and support. But the thing I was really wanting to focus on, alongside the E, which I knew was going to be there anyway, but it's the S, and particularly the coming at that from a financial services point of view through impact investing. So this is in investments which have a positive social benefit alongside the necessary financial return. And so I've been working with the Impact Investing Institute here in the city with support from KPMG, a piece of research that they've led over the past 6 months, put on another really good event back in July, the Finance for Impact Summit, and the more work is going to come out of that.
What is happening? Compared to, let's say, a year ago, what has been happening with impact investing?
Well, it's been really exciting. It was 12 months ago, following the G7 meeting, the government set up an impact task force chaired by Nick Hurd, the former government minister. He led on that. They published a really good report right at the end of the year, which again they launched here in Mansion House. So we had that as a base. We did our event in July. We've got companies committing through the Impact Investing Institute to something called the Just Transition Finance Challenge. So we've got major financial institutions, the asset managers like Schroders and others, committing capital towards assisting the just transition requirements of the world, which is something we're going to be hearing a lot more about in the coming.
Could you actually explain it to our listeners?
Well, we all recognise this. I'm sure pretty much everybody listening in, I think, recognises that we need to transition. The world needs to transition to a net zero position, and we have those. We have the objectives of getting there by 2050. Reality is we've probably got some much shorter term targets to hit if the 2050 target is going to be realistic at all. And that transition is going to require finance. And if it requires finance in the developing world, the scale of finance required if it requires finance in the developed world, in the economies like the UK and Europe and the US, the scale of the financing in the developed world, in the global south, is of a different magnitude entirely. And how we finance that transition in a just fashion, where the costs of the transition are not borne disproportionately by the developing economies, by the global south, is one of the real challenges, one of the trickiest, most difficult issues that this net zero challenge presents to us all. And we're going to hear much, much more about this in Sharm el Sheikh at COP27 in December. So we're thinking already about that. We're thinking about how do we a lot of this will require us to recognize social benefits as part of the investment strategy alongside the environmental and financial benefits. So thinking about how we combine or bring all of these together, and this is really where we come into the just transition.
But there has been a backlash, I mean, especially in the US. And in fact, there was somebody from HSBC recently who was fired for his comments. And his comments just saying, well, that it was a load of cultural. He wasn't arguing that global warming wasn't happening, but he was saying that it was too much emphasis on it, too much box ticking, and it was impeding proper investment. What's your view on that?
Well, I think he has sort of clarified that particular former HSBC banker has clarified his comments and his little analysis. What he was trying to say was a tiny bit more sophisticated. It maybe has but I think we have to recognize, you're absolutely right, the political environment, particularly in the US, is very hostile to the ESG agenda generally. We've got all those red states, the Republican voting states across the middle of the US, many of whom have now got quite anti-ESG policies in place. And many of the US financial institutions are finding it very difficult to carry on business in some of those states because of those policies. So, my view is that we're in a very difficult political, the geopolitics of the moment are very difficult. But if they've taught us anything, it's the need to have resilient, shorter supply chains, and in the energy sector, more particularly than anything else. Yeah, looking ahead a couple of years, when we get through this period of geopolitical turbulence, we will want to make sure that we have energy supplies we can rely upon that are locally sourced, that we can control. And the best form of energy in that respect is going to be renewables, particularly in countries like the UK, where if we wanted to, we could generate as much energy as we needed from wind power. Now we won't do that because we won't put wind turbines everywhere we need to do that, but you know, theoretically we could. So I believe that this period we're living through will actually give renewables and the case for renewables a huge impetus in coming years, and we're just going to see renewed investment. And those in the red states of the US and in other parts of the world where there's resistance to it, I think they will find that the good, solid capitalist arguments for investment in this area will ultimately trump some of the other, I'm not using that word other than in using it advisedly or otherwise, that will push investment into these areas and actually pull it in. There's really good reasons, there's absolutely good capitalist reasons for focusing on these global markets of the future, carbon markets, voluntary carbon market trading. All of these are
great opportunities, aren't they?
They are huge opportunities, and they're a huge opportunity for London and the UK as a global financial center. I've been saying this for the last few years that it may be the right thing to do for the planet, but it's certainly the right thing to do for the City of London to focus on these future markets that will be at the heart of finance for generations to come.
Going back, Lord Mayor, to people, I sat at a dinner in the City of London the other night. There was the Worshipful Company of International Bankers, a livery company, where the next master who was being installed then was called Jason Van Praagh, an Australian. And he said to me, I arrived in the city 30 years ago with nothing but a backpack and huge ambition. And here I am now. I am being installed as the master of the Worshipful Company of International Bankers. What a mouthful. And he said, that is something that I don't think it can happen in the City of London anymore. Would you agree?
I would agree and disagree on that one. I disagree in the sense that I think the opportunities presented by the City of London for young, diverse talent from around the world are as great as they've ever been. So, I think it's a much more international, much more diverse city than it was when I started working, as I'm sure it was the case for you. The number of nationalities you interact with on a daily basis now, if you're working in a city institution or even just going and getting a coffee. I mean, it's just the city has transformed in that over the last 20 years. It's so much more international than it once was. And the reason that we still attract people want to come to the city, want to get jobs here, is because there's still these great opportunities. You build a great career. I think there are some issues, and I haven't talked to Jason about this, but I wonder whether one of the concerns I've heard from a number of entrepreneurs who built businesses over the last few years is that the regulatory environment has become tougher and tougher, and it's harder and harder to start and scale up a business in the financial services sector. With the particularly post the global financial crisis, I hear similar comments made by some of the challenger banks and others, that there are aspects of the regulatory regime that they find really difficult, that the design for the big global financial institutions, and actually they put their undue burdens on some of these.
This is definitely on the city's wish list.
It is. We want retaining global competitiveness means that we need to make sure that new businesses can be created and they can grow and thrive. You've got to balance these things, because you can't have businesses which are unviable, or businesses which cut corners on things like, you know your client, anti-money laundering, all of it. You've got to have, these things have got to be covered off properly as well. So, but there is that balance. How much of that you impose without ultimately preventing new businesses from starting and scaling is a critical decision to make. It comes through, actually, one thing I mentioned earlier on, the Financial Services and Markets Bill that's going through the Parliament. One of the things that will do is build into the regulatory agenda, so as an objective which the regulators need to consider, competitiveness. That means that that regulatory decisions need to be informed by that lens, as well as the various other lenses that the elect regulators will apply when they're looking at an application, looking at any of the sort of policy decisions they're making. And I think that's a very welcome change to the regime, the regulatory regime.
Absolutely right. It's one of those small points that is going to have a big effect, presumably. Yeah.
It should have a big effect, and we will be looking for evidence of that from the regulators over the next few years. We'll be looking to see the regulators putting that into practice over the next few years.
Now, Vincent, you are the first Irishman who is Lord Mayor of the City of London. But when I look at the city, I think, well, we had a Canadian who was the central bank governor. We had a Frenchman who was the London Stock Exchange Group CEO, and dare I say it, the most successful in the whole history of the London Stock Exchange.
Great polymath indeed.
And this, to me, is what makes the city so unique. I mean, let's be clear, the French would never have anything other than a Frenchman in charge of the Banque de France. The Americans would never have anybody other than an American in charge of the New York Stock Exchange. Are we still as open to this, bringing in the best talent from all over the world?
I think we are. I mean, it's so great. I'm not for a minute going to put myself in the same category as the two gentlemen that you've referred to, as the Canadian and Frenchman concerned, who are both great heroes of mine. I think they're both extraordinary individuals. So, but I think you are. I think there is that we are still a very, as I've said a moment ago, actually still remain a very international, very diverse city. In fact, more international, more diverse than we've ever been. We've got to work harder. We've got to keep the focus on that. We've got to make sure we still keep the door open to the rest of the world. The changes, some of those visa changes we touched on earlier, allowing more students to come here, and then for them to get several years experience working in the finance or professional services sector after they've qualified from the LSE or whichever university they attend. Again, I think it's a really positive thing. They may move on. They may go back to Canada or France or India. But I think that experience will benefit them and will benefit us here in the UK. And of course, a certain percentage will stay, and will build great careers. And I have no doubt, in a few years' time, we'll see other nationalities in senior roles across the city. But it's not something you can take for granted. You've got to keep working at it. I often point to the example of Antwerp, which was probably London's predecessor as a great financial centre in Europe, certainly in Northern Europe, in the 1400s and the 1500s. And Antwerp closed in on itself, and it was really political and religious divisions in Antwerp that ultimately and finance bypassed Antwerp, and that happened very quickly. And London was a huge beneficiary of that. Ultimately, that really set London on the path for becoming, in the 1500s, the global financial center that it's remained to this day. And we need to bear examples like that in mind, that we've got to keep the door open and keep looking outwards, not look inwards, and don't focus, don't take anything for granted. I think your description,
overachieve.
Yeah, I think a little bit of insecurity is always a good thing in that sense. Yeah, but there's a lot of competition out there. A lot of other cities around the world would want to be where London is today. So having a little bit of insecurity, just keeping that edge there is not a bad thing at all.
The system for choosing the Lord Mayor is an archaic system, and you know, we've had some very good Lord Mayors in the last few years, but 693 of them, only two women. And could I just say, the last Lord Mayor who was a woman was 2013, almost a decade ago. That, Vincent, you and I must agree, is a scandal.
It's not great, I have to say. No, we would like more women. We'd like more women to stand for election in the city, because to increase the pool, we need more women as aldermen. I'm pleased to say that in the last few months, we've had four aldermanic elections, four seats for aldermen came up, and two of them have been filled by women. So the pipeline in the Court of Aldermen is getting bigger. And I have no doubt at all that we will see several women serving as Lord Mayor over the decade ahead of us. We will see a big change over the next few years.
I mean, I hate to say, because generally what one says with a company that never manages to get women in diversity, and you say, well, the system has got to change, because obviously there's something wrong with the system. Is there any chance of changing the system for electing the Lord Mayor?
It's not easy in the sense that it requires primary legislation and all sorts of, going back to Westminster and all sorts of other things around that don't make that an easy thing to do. So I think what we've got to do is focus on what we're doing. Let's focus on the things we're doing at the moment, which is actually talking to women in business leadership positions, encouraging them to look at it and to think about it. I mean, we will get more women standing for election and more women winning in those seats. I mean, Jeanette Newman, who was elected the other day in Walbrook, the ward in which actually Mansion House sits, a lead managing partner of Clyde, one of the major law firms with particularly strong insurance practice, Clyde & Co. She's a great example of sort of woman that we'd love to see getting elected. That means that those of us who are in the system as aldermen need to be out there trying to encourage people to stand.
Including your successors.
Absolutely, and indeed. And I've no doubt the conversations I have with my immediate predecessors and my likely successors, that is something we are convinced that we're very much focused on making that change happen. And as I say, we're beginning to see, we've got a few more elections coming up next year. A couple of the senior aldermen will be retiring next year. So I hope we'll see more diversity in more diverse candidates coming through, more success in that respect over the next couple of years.
I was lucky enough to work with you on something called the Lord Mayor's Appeal, which is basically a charity that the Lord Mayor support, and over 3 years, and we choose different charities. Now, your choice, and I remember it was slightly controversial, was the Duke of Edinburgh Awards, which I think you'll need to explain it a bit to the people listening. But at the time, some of us, and I have to admit, I was one of them, thought, well, this is for middle-class children. Why are we supporting this? But in fact, I've been proved wrong, and I'd like you to tell our viewers and our listeners why.
Well, I was very keen to support the Duke of Edinburgh Award for a very particular reason. I, going back probably about 15 years ago now, I was graduate recruitment partner for 4 years in my previous law firm. And I Growing up in Ireland, the Duke of Edinburgh was had a tiny presence in Ireland. It was almost it really
could,
didn't.
Could you just say what it is?
Well, yeah, it's an awards based charity. So it gives young people awards at three levels: bronze, silver, and gold, for activities which involve a whole range of skill sets. But it's all really about building personal resilience and capacity. Giving young people in that 16 to 23, 24 age group life skills and resilience that they learn by going on expeditions, by tackling particular challenges, by doing community work, a range of different things. And it's sort of graduated up from bronze to gold. And the gold standard is a pretty tough award to achieve. And I was finding as graduate recruitment partner that many of the very best candidates I was seeing were coming in with a Duke of Edinburgh silver or gold award and with fantastic stories about the situations they had managed, they'd found themselves in and how they dealt with it and what lessons they'd learned from that and how really they'd acquired some very powerful life skills from their Duke of Edinburgh Awards experience. And that was what engaged me. This was going back, as I say, 15 years ago. So when the opportunity arose to bring a charity into as one of our partner charities that we support through the Lord Mayor's Appeal, I thought, well, let's talk to the Duke of Edinburgh Awards. This is an organization that should be getting, as you say, it looked at perhaps middle-class kids in middle-class schools get this fantastic opportunity. We need to get that into schools and to youth centres around the country. So the children, young people that don't have the opportunity to do it, perhaps because they don't have the money or their teachers, the school doesn't train the teachers, doesn't support the teachers to as leaders in the award scheme. Let's find ways of addressing that. And we started by trying to get 10,000 young people across London doing it, who wouldn't otherwise have had the opportunity, training up 500 teachers and other youth leaders to operate as leaders and mentors on the scheme. And it is making a difference. And actually, the Duke of Edinburgh Award is now taking that program nationally as well with more philanthropic support that it's getting. They're able to prove that it can be done, showing what we've been supporting in London as a test case. And they're now scaling it up nationally as well. So I hope that our support of Duke of Edinburgh Awards will give thousands of young people that wouldn't have that opportunity, that life chance they get through the award. And it comes back to some of the issues we were talking about a few minutes ago about social mobility and about why some of the barriers that exist. And I have no doubt at all that something like a Duke of Edinburgh Awards equips people with some of the social skills that they mightn't otherwise have at the start of a career that will
not
definitely...
Not only that, but, Vincent, it also, on their CV, if you see that somebody has done that, you think, now this is somebody who's got resilience, strength, bravery. Absolutely.
And it's one of the, again, why does one CV get pulled out for an interview? Why does another? These are the little things that sometimes do help people just get their initial foot in the door by getting an interview. And all of these things, they make a huge difference. So I'm a big fan of the DVA. They operate as well. One of the really interesting things is how they operate in the secure estate, so in young offender institutions as well, which has been really interesting. And the impact it has on young people in young offender institutions, the impact it has on their reoffending rates is extraordinary. Even getting the opportunity to do the bronze award in these young offender institutions seems to have a transformative effect on the young people concerned, and it's there's an extraordinary drop off in reoffending rates amongst those who've done the DAV award in those institutions. So real evidence of social benefit.
Yeah, a very, very useful tool. Now, I think we might turn to a few questions. From Yolanda Blavo, do you think allowing employees to work flexibly, i.e. remote or hybrid, can help alleviate some of the issues associated with the cost of living?
I think it helps. I think the One of the benefits we've seen of remote working is that it is a bit of a leveling factor in, and that there's also a bit of a social mobility thing going on there as well, that it can make meetings more inclusive. People, everybody, there's an equality about meetings online, for instance, that isn't necessarily always present when you've got people around a table, but. And it does, of course, also mean that you don't have to live in a high cost part of London or the southeast of England to do a job that might otherwise be a city or a square mile sort of job. And all of those are positive factors. But I do think there's a big part of career development, social development, missing. And while I'm a supporter of more flexible working, and it's here to stay, I've no doubt it is, I think it can't be at the expense of the career and social development that comes from working and learning by spending time in an office environment, working in a team, acquiring all those sorts of skills that you do, particularly at an early point in your career. As a lawyer, I learned so much just by being in the room with more senior lawyers and seeing how they worked. The good things, you learn how to do something. You also learn how not to do something when you see some. There's all this stuff, and when you see them, you just think, I'm not going to do that. That's certainly not. You learn the lessons of what not to do as well. You just don't get those experiences online. So, yeah, it has a role, but we need to. We can't. Don't give up in the office yet, and we won't. I've no doubt the office isn't there's a great future.
I notice currently, it seems so many of the firms I talk to, it's hybrid. You know, we ask that you be in the office 2 to 3 days a week with others, and 2 days a week work from home, but we need that interaction. Now, another question, how will a 2023 recession, I think we're already in one, but anyway, affect the city and the people who work here?
I think we are going to be affected by it. I think there's going to be a number of effects, sort of direct and indirect. I think we're already beginning to hear mutterings about job losses, for instance, in the city. I think it's inevitable that the turn down in activity in investment banking, for instance, we will see banks and financial institutions having to make some tough decisions about job losses in the coming months. And of course, we're also going to see pressure, the inflationary pressures. Everybody's pay packet is going to feel rather less than it did 6 or 12 or 18 months ago, as with inflation and with interest rate rises and all the rest of it coming through. It's not going to feel good, and that won't matter whether you're working in the city or whatever sector of the economy you're in. I think we're in for a bit of a tough time. We need to have a look as an industry, as I've mentioned, about how we respond to that. And as a city, I think we need just to focus. It just means that we need to focus even harder on the things where we can make a difference around promoting growth, about making sure that international investment keeps coming into the UK. Doing all those things, probably working even harder to achieve them. But it's not going to be easy for anybody. It's also going to be interesting to see. I suspect we'll probably see people maybe coming into the office a tiny bit more over this coming winter, because it makes more sense to, instead of spending 3 days, maybe 3 days in the office, 2 days at home, people might choose to come in one more day into the office and leave the heating and lighting off at home one day. That will be a significant saving for a lot of people over the coming winter.
That interests me is, you know, it looks like there will be people losing their jobs. And we have had a talent shortage up to now. So, you know, will this actually alleviate? Is this a bit of a silver lining in this horrible black cloud?
I don't know. And I think one of the big economic issues that the economists are trying to work through, because is this issue of the sort of the great resignation, as it's been called, this withdrawal of many millions from the workforce, and there's a growing evidence around this that it seems to be related in very large measure to ill health. It's partly also being driven by people taking a decision during the pandemic that they've they can retire a little bit earlier now, and maybe some of those might be forced to look at jobs again if they find, in fact, as inflation and other factors come into play, that their savings won't stretch quite as far as they thought they would stretch, and some of them may be forced to come back into the workforce when they weren't planning to do so. It's hard to tell. And you talk to the economists, talk to senior people at the Bank of England, as I have, and they're as perplexed by this issue as anybody. But I say there is growing evidence now that this a big part of this is related to health, and actually that this problem started pre-pandemic, but has probably been exacerbated by COVID, possibly long COVID, possibly the fact that people weren't getting treated for other illnesses over the pandemic period, and we've had a build-up of this in the economy over the past, say, 3 years or so. Now that's not going to be. There may be a little bit of alleviation of the margins by a reduction in, but I think these are separate problems. And how we tackle the great resignation, and where that goes, I'm not sure. And I don't think the chief economist, I don't think Hugh Pill in the Bank of England would, if he was on this podcast, would have an answer to that one either.
This is more of a comment than a question, but I think it's a very interesting one. So I just want to put it out there so that anybody else who, when they listen to the podcast, can hear it, which is in response to the Lord Mayor's point on lack of diverse senior people in financial services, there's an initiative, Embrace Your Career, that has been launched by the Diversity Project's Race and Ethnicity Workstream. The Diversity Project, I think, is the asset management industry's diversity, that looks exactly at the gap of ethnically diverse senior leaders in the finance industry. The initiative is formed of 8 videos and a toolkit for organizations that highlight the challenges, barriers, and insights. Anyway, I'd like to just put that out there. And
I'm aware of that one. I don't know. I've certainly heard of it, and I know of the Diversity Project, but it's great. There's lots of these fantastic initiatives. What we need to do across this whole area is to try and make sure that more of these initiatives are signposted by ease, and then that there isn't any sense of competition, that we actually try and get these initiatives all pulling in the same direction, maybe focused on race, maybe focused on gender, maybe focused on social mobility. Let's get these all pulling in the same direction, because what we're missing at the moment in this area is a multiplier effect, and we need to find a way of creating that multiplier effect with all of these initiatives. It really, really is sparking off each other, and that's something that I want to progress together. The role I see progress together in the financial services sector is very much with that in mind.
I'm just going to give it's www.diversityproject.com/embraceyourcareer. Now, Lord Mayor, I have time for one short answer from you, a minute. What is keeping you awake at night?
One thing that keeps me awake at night, if people ask me about what I worry about most about London, and as Lord Mayor, that's something I do concern. Well, it's around the sort of the capital markets, the world, and we're seeing a lot of pressures, a lot of disaggregation in markets, a lot of balkanization, if you wish, and that I am concerned that the geopolitics of the world at the moment are creating divisions, divides, barriers, which is not good for London, fundamentally not good for the world. I think there's great arguments. This is probably longer than a minute, and I won't. There's lots of, you can argue about globalization and positives and negatives, and that's the thing. I believe that a lot of globalization, particularly around the capital markets, has been hugely positive to the world. And I'm very concerned that we're living in a world where much of those benefits are being lost. That is a real concern, because again, let's come back to my reference earlier on to Antwerp. We need to make sure that those forces are being countered.
No, and you're absolutely right in that, you know, the reality is for a company to grow, it needs finance. And the bigger the pool and the fewer impediments to raising that finance makes all the difference. And the bigger a company grows, the more people it employs. You know, it's a wonderful, Now, Lord Mayor, you're about to, I think in about a month, you get to take a rest. But then you'll be busy with your social mobility project, and I think that will keep you very busy for the next 2 years. So thank you very, very much for talking to the Inclusion Initiative. To our audience, to the Lord Mayor, many thanks. And to our audience, thank you for listening and goodbye.